You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 15th of November, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, yesterday we looked at the government's failing attempts to deal with the migration crisis, with all the money that they're sending over to France, basically doing exactly the same thing as every other Home Secretary has done, which has resulted in each year the number of illegal immigrants coming into the country doubling. Today I want to have a look at what the immigrants end up doing once they are actually within the country. And of course, the same thing is happening in most of Northern Europe. It's not happening in Eastern Europe. The countries that were formerly communist seem to have much more of a nationalist sentiment than the countries in North of Europe. It could also be that in Northern Europe there are higher wages than get paid in Eastern Europe as well. So that is part of the pull factor as to why people from other countries wish to come to Northern Europe. But a survey was published in September that has shown that the vast majority of refugees living in Sweden have vacationed in the country that they actually fled from, although hardly any wish to ever return permanently. So this gives us an idea that most of these people that are actually claiming asylum are not actually living in fear for their lives in the countries that they actually come from. It's about 80% of these so-called refugees that end up going back to the country that they claim to have fled from on holiday. And it's the same situation in Sweden as it is in Britain. There are no countries that are surrounding Sweden that are currently at war. And if you're supposed to claim asylum in the first country that you come to that is safe, then that means that all of these so-called asylum seekers in Sweden, they're just as fake as the asylum seekers are in Britain. And I dare say, if we were to take a poll like this of the ones in Britain, that a lot of them end up going back to the countries that they claim to have fled from as well. The survey, which was conducted by the polling firm Novus, claims that around 85% of people living in Sweden born overseas have gone on vacation to their home country, and that among people who are supposed to be refugees, the number is around 79%, despite the fact they are in Sweden in the first place because they were supposedly forced to flee said home country. So just out of people that are born abroad anyway, it's 85% that end up going back to those countries that they were born in. And amongst the people that claim to be fleeing that country, it's 79%. So it's pretty much the same figure, isn't it? And I think this really does show that the people that are trying to break into our countries, claiming that they're fleeing bad treatment in their home countries, they're really just economic migrants, and they really should be called out for being economic migrants. The results also reveal that very few migrants ever wish to return to their home countries permanently, with just 2% saying they planned to return in the future, and only 16% said they might consider it, the online newspaper Bulletin, which commissioned the survey, reports. And again, this shows that they're just fake asylum seekers, aren't they? If they were claiming asylum from bad conditions at home, say a war in Syria, as soon as the war was over, you would think that they would want to go back and help to rebuild the country. If they only left the country because it was in trouble at the time, why would they not want to go back? when there was no more trouble there. I dare say that a lot of these people are leaving these countries because they've created problems for themselves in the country that they're leaving from. Perhaps they are criminally minded, perhaps they carried out crimes in the country of their birth, and the people there didn't want them. So they end up heading for Europe and claiming to be asylum seekers. Now, I'm not suggesting that that is all of them that are like that, but this is what I was told. I was actually told this in a non-white country. I got on very well with the people that were there, the inhabitants of the country, and I asked them what the immigrants from that country were like in Britain. And I asked, are they as friendly as you guys? Are they the same sort of people as you? And I wasn't a nationalist at the time. And they said, no, don't have anything to do with them. They're all the people that we don't want in our own country. They're all criminally minded people that leave our country because they're not wanted here. And they go into Europe. And he said, don't have anything to do with them. So that comes from the horse's mouth, saying that the people that are emigrating from these other countries, non-white countries, are the criminally minded types that are not wanted within their own country. That, and you could just say, well, but perhaps that there's just a bad lot of people that that they knew about that were in that country. But that is still what somebody's experience is. Even if it's just an anecdote, that is still what somebody's experience is. Of those surveyed who came to Sweden from a country outside of the European Union, a total of 81% said they would be looking to permanently stay in Sweden. Just over half the respondents stated that Sweden was a better country to raise children compared to their home country, while 9% said Sweden was worse than their homelands. Well, if Sweden is worse than their homelands, then why are they not going back to their homelands? Obviously, Europe is part of the first world, isn't it? And a lot of these countries that these people are leaving to come to Europe, they're a part of the third world. So it's obviously going to be a benefit to them to be in Europe. They're going to have higher wages, they're going to have a better standard of living. And if we just open up Europe to them, it just means that Europe is just going to be swamped by people from the third world. And why is the third world like the third world? Of course, people on the left will say because it just hasn't been developed enough by white people. But there's also the other argument that the reason why it's like that is because the people that are there have made it like that. That's the reason why Africa is like it is, because Africans have made it like it is. I mean, all different people groups have different abilities, different character. Of course, we're not generalizing about individuals here. There are always different individuals. But you can look at groups and you can look at group behavior and you can look at what groups have achieved. And some groups are civilization building groups and other groups don't have a history of building a civilization. And if you bring the groups that don't have a history of building a civilization into countries that do have a civilization, the only end result is going to be from that, if the people that don't have the ability to build a civilization outbreed the ones that do, then you're just going to end up losing the civilization. Immigration is not of benefit to Europe at all, to allow immigration from outside of it. Eventually, it's just going to completely swamp Europe unless people do something about it. And you could say that it is good in a certain way because it racializes people. People become aware of their ethnicity. They become aware of the risk to their country. And people then start identifying with their ethnicity and they want to do something to protect their people and they become more aware of their identity. So we do actually become more nationalist minded, I think, when we have multiculturalism, when we have these other groups around us, because it reminds us that we ourselves are different to these other groups, and it's the same for them as well. Since the height of the 2015-2016 migrant crisis, several countries have noted that those claiming refugee status have frequently travelled back to the country that they fled from for holidays. Now, surely if they are doing that, when they come back, the country should say, well, quite clearly, the place that you've just gone on holiday to is not a threat to you anymore, is it? If you've just been there on holiday, we gave you asylum, we gave you somewhere safe to live in, and now quite clearly your original country that you came from is safe. So we're not going to allow you back into the country. I don't know why they don't do that, because this is clearly showing that they were claiming asylum under false pretenses, surely. In Germany, former Interior Minister Horst Seehofer spoke out on the topic in 2019, threatening to revoke the asylum status of Syrians who were going back to their home country on vacation, arguing that they could not make serious claims of persecution if they travelled back home for recreation. And of course, Bashar al-Assad has said to the Syrians, you should come back to Syria and help to rebuild the country. And you would think that now that the majority of Syria is not at war, you would think that the loyal Syrians that are in Germany would want to go back to their country and help rebuild it. The fact that they don't really sort of says that they're not really very good people, are they? They're the sort of people that the Syrians that stayed in Syria would not want to actually come back to their country. But they're also the sort of people that Germany would not want within its country. It's the sort of people that you wouldn't want within Britain either. Earlier that same year, a Syrian blogger who came to Germany as a refugee had complained about not being able to go on vacation in Syria, stating that Germany was stressful for him and he needed a break. And of course it's going to be stressful for you living amongst different people groups, and people do want to be amongst their own kind. It's just a natural desire that we have to be amongst people that look like us, that sound like us, that we can feel at home with. It's the same reason why we like to be with our families, because we're close to our family. And it is exactly the same instinct that is involved there with this desire to be amongst our own people group. The populist Sweden Democrats, who are now a part of the ruling coalition in Sweden, have argued for much stricter immigration policies, including a proposal to remigrate migrants who have failed to integrate into Sweden's society or labour market, or who have been involved in criminal activity. So they're saying that they would like to remigrate the migrants that remain unemployed. And this was drawn attention to the other day, I think, by the guy that killed himself after throwing a couple of petrol bombs at the Marsden Holding Centre for migrants. And he was pointing out that we have people in the country who don't speak English. Why are they not sanctioned when they claim their benefits? Because they're claiming benefits, they're claiming job seekers allowance. And if you're claiming job seekers allowance, you are supposed to look for work. You're supposed to do all that you can to actually look for work. And if you're not able to speak English, then they should be going on courses so that they can speak English. If they don't know how to speak English, that's their fault. If they're living in England, they should know how to speak English. So why are they not being sanctioned? So there is this issue that we have people that are living over here that are basically claiming benefits rather than actually working. And it seems like this is the same situation throughout Europe. The populist Sweden Democrats have called for the repatriation of Syrians, Afghans and Somalis, noting their rate of unemployment and high numbers who have not integrated. And what they mean by not integrated means that they're not even learning how to speak Swedish. Party leader Jimmy Åkesson and migration policy spokesman Ludvig Aspling have said the Swedish government needs to do more to return migrants to their homelands if they rely on state benefits and do not integrate. Since 2010, Sweden has granted over 1.2 million residence permits, equivalent to more than a brand new Stockholm. Unemployment is almost five times higher among the foreign-born compared to the native-born, the pair wrote in a debate article for the newspaper Aftonbladet. So they are five times more likely to be claiming benefits than Swedes are. So you can effectively say that for each Swede that is unemployed, there are five non-whites that are unemployed, that are claiming benefits. How is that of any benefit to the country to just be paying out money like this? The pair add that among Syrians, Afghans and Somalis, half of the adults earn incomes less than 100,000 Swedish krona, which is about £8,000 or $10,000 per year. and that among foreign-born residents in general, some 600,000 are not self-sufficient. So they're just being a drain on the economy, really. And I thought, well, let's have a look at what the British statistics are here. And of course, in Britain, we don't have statistics on ethnicity, but we can look and we can see, well, Syrians, Afghans and Somalis, they're all Muslims, aren't they? And we do have some British statistics on Muslims. With regards towards the whole Muslim population, a House of Commons report suggested that the unemployment rate is estimated at 13%. Now, the normal unemployment rate is about 5%. So it's just about three times the normal unemployment rate. The report showed this trend is continued when we look at the full-time employment rate, with only 20% of Muslims aged between 16 and 74 in full-time employment. So only a fifth of the Muslims in Britain are actually working a full-time job. Now, you can say that they are also including women in this. The Women's and Equalities Committee states that British Muslims also experience the lowest earnings of any religious group, earning £350 less each month than average. Only 6% of Muslims are in higher managerial, administrative and professional occupations, compared to 10% of the overall population. So even the ones that are working are really not earning that much money. They're really taking more out of the system than they are actually putting in. The figures go on to break down the data by gender. Of all the unemployed Muslims in the UK, 65% are female and 35% are male. 29% of Muslim women between the ages of 16 and 24 are in employment, compared to approximately half the general population. For the age group 25 to 49, the numbers show 57% of Muslim women in employment, compared with 80% of women overall. So, I mean, it's pretty much, you can average it out and say that they're twice as likely to be unemployed. And if they are employed, then they're earning significantly less. And of course, people will say, well, this is because of Islamophobia. This is because the people that employ them are Islamophobic. Is that the reason, though? Or is the reason because they don't speak English? The women are looked upon in a different way in Islamic culture. Male Muslims don't expect their women to work. They don't expect their wives to work. And I think a lot of the male Muslims, the extremely observant ones, they may be happy just getting benefits and doing Islamic studies. And they will use the benefits so that they can do these Islamic studies, and they will see it that they're leading a fulfilling life by doing studies and preaching Islam rather than working. We also have a large number that are on disability benefits, and the reason for that is because you have a lot of very close marriage between cousins, and there are studies that have been done on that. A BBC investigation in Britain several years ago revealed that at least 55% of the Pakistani community in Britain was married to a first cousin. The Times of India affirmed that this is thought to be linked to the probability that a British Pakistani family is at least 13 times more likely than the general population to have children with recessive genetic disorders. The BBC's research also discovered that while British Pakistanis accounted for just 3.4% of all births in Britain, they accounted for 30% of all British children with recessive disorders and a higher rate of infant mortality. It is not a surprise, therefore, that in response to this evidence, a Labour Party MP has called for a ban on first cousin marriage. Medical evidence shows that one of the negative consequences of inbreeding is a 100% increase in the risk of stillbirths. One study comparing Norwegians and Pakistanis shows the risk that the child dies during labour increases by 50%. The risk of death due to autosomal recessive disorders, e.g. cystic fibrosis and spinal muscular atrophy, is 18 times higher. Risk of death due to malformations is 10 times higher. Mental health is also at risk. The probability of depression is higher In communities where consanguine marriages are also high, the closer the blood relative, the higher the risk of mental and physical retardation and schizophrenic illness. So a lot of them are on disability benefits because of this close marriage that they have. And of course, this is not to not to insult Muslims. This is just pointing out what the statistics are and questioning why it is that our government are encouraging this when quite clearly it's just causing a drain on the population, a drain on the economy, rather than adding to the economy, which is the excuse that they use. Getting back to the Sweden Democrats, they say remigration is not a miracle solution, but the failures of recent decades show that it must be an option, a solution for all those who live in long-term exclusion, they said, noting that while Sweden does have a subsidy for those wishing to return to their home countries, it is seldom used. And I don't think we even have a subsidy over here in Britain for encouraging people to return to their home countries. Incentive structures and the welfare system must be reformed so that people in exclusion cannot get caught up in welfare dependency, but are either forced into society or encouraged to remigrate, they wrote. And I think Patriotic Alternative have a good solution to this. I mean, they say if everything was just written in English and people were expected to learn English, and if they couldn't speak English, an interpreter would not be provided for them, or it would be, but they would then be billed for that. I think that would at least prevent people from thinking that they can live in Britain without speaking the English language. And also then, if people were to be sanctioned, if they were to be claiming benefits and they couldn't speak English, well, for a start, they wouldn't be able to fill out the benefits forms, would they? Because they wouldn't be able to speak English. And this would prevent them from living in exclusion from the rest of the country, at least. I mean, that would be the reason for doing this, because we don't want people to be living in separate communities, cut off from everybody else, because they don't speak the English language. Well, the best way to get them to speak English is to insist upon it and not provide interpreters. And if you were to do that, some of these people might say, well, I would rather go back to living in a Muslim country rather than have to learn to speak English. And then you could say to them, well, we will help you out with a subsidy if you wish to go back to your country. And that's the sort of thing that they have in Sweden. That's the sort of thing that they have in Denmark. I don't think that we have this in Britain at the moment. But that would be one way to do this, to encourage people to integrate and to also encourage a certain number that wanted to go back to their home countries to go back. Eggerson and Aspling also cited the Danish approach to repatriating migrants, quoting Danish government minister Mattias Tesfaye, who has previously stated his goal is that Denmark would receive zero asylum seekers. And Mattias Tesfaye is actually of immigrant heritage himself. Rather like our Home Secretary, Suella Braveman, at the moment, who says that her dream would be to have no illegal immigration in Britain and to have illegal immigrants being taken off to Rwanda, to a country that does want economic migrants. The concept of remigration was also used by former French presidential candidate Eric Zemmour during his campaign earlier this year. The populist said that he wished to create a new government ministry specifically to deal with the issue. And a lot of attention was drawn to Eric Zemmour. I think Jared Taylor in particular was particularly enamoured by him. I think he was an Algerian Jew by heritage, which basically meant that he could get away with saying a lot of things that French people would, or people of French ethnicity, he would be accused of being a racist for doing so. So Eric Zemmour did make full use of the fact that he had this Jewish heritage, and he could get away with saying things that perhaps the normal French people couldn't. Zemmour proposed to send at least 1 million migrants back to their countries over a period of 5 years. And a poll released in March this year revealed that around two-thirds of French people supported a mass remigration of illegals, foreigners on terrorist watch lists, and foreign criminals. So the sort of people that are going to be causing trouble. I mean, it doesn't say here people of foreign ethnicity who are unemployed or who haven't integrated, but that is the sort of thing that the general public would get behind, I think. So we have the government paying out all this money at the moment in hotels, paying out all this money to France to try and stop the illegal immigration, and it hasn't done any good. And the ones that are actually here, they're not really very likely to be working and adding money to the economy either, which is what we are told that they are here to be doing. And it also seems that it was expected that the money that's being paid out to these hotels would actually come from the foreign aid budget. But it doesn't seem as if that is what has been going on. The supposedly cash-strapped British government, currently preparing punishing tax hikes and public service cuts to balance the books, will overspend by around £1 billion on foreign aid due to the migrant influx. And this is quite good. They're adding the amount of money that's being paid on these illegal immigrants to the foreign aid budget and saying, well, that's coming out of foreign aid. I mean, what they should really be doing is deducting this, the costs of this, from the foreign aid, but they're not. They're adding to it, so it's just an extra cost. Around £4 billion of the British government's £11 billion foreign aid budget is being spent on dealing with asylum seekers in Britain itself, paying for them to enjoy free accommodation in luxurious hotels, while paying customers are booted out, for example, which is a permissible use of so-called official development assistance, to which the government has inexplicably bound itself. So if the cost of these hotels was to actually come from the foreign aid budget, then only 7 billion, which is still a lot of money, but 7 billion would be going overseas and 4 billion would be going on these hotels. But what they're actually doing is they're still sending 11 billion pounds overseas, and then they're also spending 4 billion on top of that on putting illegal immigrants up in hotels. So the foreign aid budget is actually 15 billion pounds a year. While taxpayers might expect that this would mean Britain simply had less money to literally give away to other countries at a time when they are warned they will be denied tax cuts and made to endure tax hikes, public service cuts, and a decline in real terms income in order to tackle inflation and a cost of living and energy crisis, this is apparently not the case, with the BBC reporting that spending will instead be allowed to go around £1 billion over budget to make up the shortfall. So regardless of how difficult it is for British citizens and the indigenous British people to afford to live at the moment, the government are still going to be sending out all this money in foreign aid. We also have Rishi Sunak saying that he's going to be giving reparations to Pakistan and Africa for climate change, and that's on top of the foreign aid budget. Across government, there are significant pressures on the ODA budget due to the costs of accepting refugees from Afghanistan and Ukraine, as well as wider migration challenges. We remain one of the largest global aid donors, spending more than £11 billion in aid in 2021, and UK aid has recently gone towards those in need in the Horn of Africa and Pakistan, said a statement from the Jeremy Hunt-led Treasury on the situation. Apparently concerned with mollifying those who believe Britain should be giving away even more money, rather than conservatives who tend to view the foreign aid budget with justified scepticism. And this is the really bizarre thing. I mean, all these conservative voters, they don't want immigration. Yet the conservative government seems to think that they want the opposite of that, and they want more immigration, and they want more money to be given away. All spending decisions will be considered in the round by the Chancellor at the autumn statement, the statement added. And we are waiting for this budget. And we've been told over here in Britain at the moment that there will be taxes that are going up and there will be less money to go around. And yet, even with that happening, we still have illegal immigrants being put up in hotels. We still have a foreign aid budget that's being spent. And now we're told that billions are going to go on these climate change reparations that Rishi Sunak has put out. I mean, whichever way you look at it, the administration that we have in Britain is not doing what is best for the British citizens in in any way, and I'm not really quite sure who it is that they're actually serving, and who it is that they are actually benefiting by encouraging all this illegal immigration and by giving all these funds out. Because it doesn't matter how much money you invest into Africa, it's so corrupt. The money is just going to go on the elite in Africa, amassing even more wealth. I mean, we see this happening in South Africa, don't we? The leaders of South Africa, they live in palaces, while the people, the lowly citizens, are in a terrible state. And it's the same thing in all over Africa. You have this corruption, which really tends to say it doesn't matter how much money you put in, it's not going to solve the problem. So it's just an endless waste of money. And when we allow them to come into Britain as illegal immigrants, it just causes a drain on our resources. As we see, even the ones that actually do go out and work, they really don't earn enough to be adding to the system. They are just a drain on the system. This is what happens when you have multiculturalism. This is the reason why you should really have mono-ethnic countries just based around the particular ethnic nation that lives there. You should have a government that is a majoritarian government that is made up of that ethnic nation, representatives of that ethnic nation, doing what is best for that ethnic nation. And if you had that system throughout the world, in every different country, I firmly believe that things would be so much better for everyone. Not just better for one group. You know, this is the accusation we get made at us. We're told we're white supremacists and we just want what's best for us. I genuinely do believe it would be best for everyone to have a mono-ethnic country and to have representation made up of your extended kinship group, because then the people that were in government would have blood ties to you, just the same as you have blood ties to your family, and they would want to do what is best for you. And then you would have all these different countries doing what was best for each other, instead of trying to do what's best for everyone, which just means that you don't actually do what's best for anyone at all, because you're trying to do what's best for everyone. And it's not possible to do what's best for everyone. So really only possible to do what's best for your people. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.